Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. The podcast of Leading LDS. My name is Kurt Frankham. I am your host. And one thing you may not know about me is I recently just sold my condo in South Salt Lake and I'm headed to Woods Cross, Utah. And so if you're in Woods Cross, I invite you to look me up. Let's go to lunch and show me the area. This episode was one that I was definitely looking forward to interviewing. I interview an author, Craig Harleen, who's actually a professor of European history at BYU. And he wrote a book called Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. And this book is a leadership book, whether Craig Harleen meant to make it that way, but in my opinion, it is. And he talks about his experience in the 70s serving in Belgium as a young missionary and going there with these great expectations of being heroic and being a missionary that converts many people. And what he learned about himself in that process, which really the gospel teaches all of us, which is the grace of Jesus Christ and the power it can have in our life as we enable that power of the atonement. And definitely a fun read. And we talk about this experience and what we can learn in preparing missionaries of not setting false expectations or expectations that are sort of hyperbole and out there and too much, but really giving them a healthy expectation. So when they get there, they aren't surprised by the hard work, by the day-to-day difficulties that many missionaries face. I know I did. So here's my interview with Craig Harleen, author of Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. Today I'm with Craig Harleen, and he actually lives in Provo, but is currently in Belgium. Is that right, Craig?
That's right.
Nice. And you teach at BYU?
Also, yes, correct.
Cool. And you are the author of various books, but one that I recently read called Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled, but not even close to tragic confessions of a real life Mormon missionary. And this talks about your time in Belgium as a young missionary in the 70s, right?
That's exactly right.
And what led you to writing a book about your mission?
I think I've wanted to write it ever since I got home in 1977. Well, at least since about 1980. Because that's when I started having this dream that I had to go on another mission, and it terrified me. And I felt really guilty about having that dream because I thought, why would I be terrified if a mission was such a great thing? You know, why, or if I was such a good missionary, why did I have those kinds of dreams? And so, of course, I just kind of suffered through that. And for years I had them, and I'd wake up in a sweat, and sometimes I'd have to go back alone. Sometimes I was just getting ready to go home when the mission president would say, sorry, you got to stay two more years. Sometimes it was with my wife and kids. Sometimes I had to leave my wife and kids, and came in all varieties. And again, I was really embarrassed about this. And I was sure I was only the only one having this dream. And after about 15 years of this, I finally started mentioning it to people just to see how strange I might have been. And I found out probably more than half the people I asked were also having that dream. So it wasn't unusual at all. And I started trying to make distinctions between those who had it and those who didn't have it. And I saw some patterns. But anyway, I think it was that made me think, you know, I guess this is something I need to process and think about and work out. And I think also what motivated it was reading the kinds of books that were written about missions. They tended to be in two basic varieties. And one was the everything was great and it fit the ideal kind of mission. And the other was the kind of scandalous expose written by people who'd had a horrible experience and really didn't want anything more to do with religion. And although I didn't doubt that both of those experiences could have been genuine for the people who wrote about them, I had the sense that most missionaries probably were somewhere in between. And what we needed was something written about those who were just kind of trying, doing their best, and were still trying to make sense of it, even many years after the fact, maybe. And, you know, who probably mostly stayed in the church. But, yeah, anyway. But, again, I felt like, sure, some people fit perfectly into mission culture. I realize that. And some people just probably shouldn't have gone, but most people are just trying to make yourself fit somehow.
Yeah. And well, you can definitely put me on the list of people who've had the dream of going back to the mission. I think that's more common than not. And the thing I guess I loved about the book, and it spoke so much about leadership to me, and whether you intended this or not, but just we sort of set expectations for ourselves, whether it's missions or becoming a bishop or an elders' quorum president, and we go into these callings, we realize that, you know, the heavens don't just open at our demand, and revelation just doesn't come, you know, at every moment of the day as we're, you know, ordained with these keys and powers or authority. But there's a natural ebb and flow to a lot of this. There's humanity is definitely mixed in there. And I had, you know, as I read the book, I kept looking on the cover, making sure I wasn't the one that wrote this book, because it really sang true to my experience as a young missionary of just realizing, whoa, like this isn't, the day-to-day is just sort of lame and slow and nothing much happens. But then there's these flashes of miracles here and there that teach a deeper lesson. And I think that's in general the theme of what you're going for your book.
Yeah, maybe the theme is probably even a little bigger than that, because of course I've thought about it a long time. And in my work as a historian, I'm thinking about this theme all the time. I'm a cultural and religious historian. And one of the things you notice, you probably learn this from life, but you really see it when you study culture and religion, is that in probably just about everything you do, you have some kind of ideal in your head, whether it's sports or being a missionary or being in some position, whatever you are as a parent, there's some ideal you have in your head. And that's not necessarily bad. I mean, you kind of need these ideals. Yeah. They're a starting point. Our problem is we tend to look at them not as starting points, but as ending points. And if we don't end there, we might consider ourselves a failure. And a mission is a classic place to set yourself up for that. And what I mean by a starting point is that, again, it's good to have something to strive toward. If you want to play sports, you know, there's probably some ideal person that you have in mind. And what happens when you're not as good as that person? You know, are you a total failure? You're not. But, you know, you use that person as an inspiration, and then you kind of create your own kind of ideal. You create your own truth almost. And that's what we fail to do. And that's what I learned to do implicitly on a mission. Nobody ever articulated that for me. It was something you learn through hard knocks. Probably a lot of missionaries learn it, is that, you know, you probably won't live up to that ideal. Maybe there are a few who do, but you're probably not going to live up to that. And so in order to avoid feeling a failure, you have to realize, gee, I got to create what I think my own truth is about this. And that really helps as you go on to be a parent, as you go on to do any number of things, to just kind of understand ideals and reality correctly. You don't have to throw ideals out, but you don't have to use them as the only way to measure yourself. You know, it's the same thing in regard to looks or whatever. Do I fit the perfect body, the perfect face? What, you know, you don't. Yeah. You make your own particular contribution, but you're not necessarily a failure if you don't reach those things. So I think that's the transcendent message, I suppose, of the book.
Yeah, I love that. And it reminds me of a quote by Barbara Smith, who's the Relief Society General President, who said, ideals are stars to guide ourselves by, not sticks to beat ourselves with. And I think on a mission is a great kind of a great example of, you sort of leave with this ideal that you hope to accomplish, but through the process, you find what the true ideal is, right? And I love the experiences you shared in that.
Yeah, you also find out, I think, I mean, it's true that, and I say this in the book, I got all kinds of things out of being a missionary, but they weren't at all what I thought I would get. And that's what you have to be open to. And I think most missionaries probably experience that. And it's something else that you get out of it. And that's why I say you have to be open to this new ideal of that will give it value.
Yeah. And just to sort of give an example of some of these expectations that many missionaries set, because there's such hyperbole, I feel like, in the church sometimes in our culture where, you know, you talk about this concept of homecoming talks of being, you know, they talk about the best experiences and it's just like, wow, like, I remember as a young man listening to those thinking, I can't wait to go. And tell us about the story about when this number was 84 that came to your mind right before you left on your mission.
That's right. Somehow this number, just before I left, I was doing some work and I had this image of this number 84. And it's like, yeah, why shouldn't I be able to convert 84 people? You know, you can do whatever you want. And everybody tells me how special I am and You know, we're the special generation. I'm a special person. And so why shouldn't I be able to do whatever I want if I have enough faith and so on? And yeah, I mean, I wasn't even close. I described the one person I did baptize in very shaky circumstances, and it wasn't even close. And so again, if you kind of just think that, I mean, this is the thing with the ideal too. It's great to say, here's the ideal, and now use that as a starting point to guide your own ideal. The problem is the rhetoric around missions is not about finding your own ideal. It's about you have to do this ideal or you haven't succeeded. So we kind of do it to each other, whether we're leaders, whether we're fellow missionaries or whatever. We kind of beat each other up on this. We act like this is the only reality. And falling short of the ideal is not falling short of the ideal. It's a lack of faith. It's not, you know, there's not reality is the ideal. That's the problem, as I see it.
Yeah. And I think in church leadership, I, you know, I remember my time as a bishop, individuals coming in with, whether it's a trial or an addiction they're struggling with, and they'd always default to, okay, my life isn't in the ideal spot, so it must be that I'm not reading the scriptures enough. It must be that I'm not praying enough. And if I just spend an extra 10 minutes, you know, this will all sort itself out. And I think on the mission, missionaries get ingrained in that thought process of, well, the reason why we didn't baptize is I'm missing something. It's all about me, right?
Yeah, and it's not just because some individual missionary is thinking that. Again, it's because this is what you're being told, you know? We would have, and you respect these leaders, I would have some leaders come through who would say, you know, we really appreciate you. You just do your best. This is the time of planting seeds or whatever. Do your best. And then somebody else would come through. It's like, oh, you don't have enough faith. You obviously aren't working hard enough. You're not, you know, you don't, you must be breaking and sinning and so on. And that was the one I always believed. You know, even though I'd hear both of those, I tend to believe the harsher one. And I think that's probably not uncommon too. And so then you just end up feeling lousy about the whole thing.
Yeah. So what thoughts do you have as far as helping young missionaries set expectations as they leave on the mission? Because of course we don't want to, you know, paint this gloomy picture of, you know, you're gonna hate this. It's gonna be hard work. But hey, there's those moments. Obviously, that nobody want to paint that picture. But what would you say to what did you say to your own kids as they left on their mission to help them set healthy expectations?
Yeah, I told them some of my horrible stories, and I didn't say, oh, but don't worry, everything will end up being right. I just said, you know, it's going to be good and bad. And like every experience, you take something out of it. You learn stuff from it. And I think the other thing about my book, I didn't feel the obligation at the end, because again, this is a pattern I saw, at least in, you know, so-called faith-promoting books, was that, oh, sure, it was hard, but in the end, it all was worth it. And what I say is, it's an experience that I got a lot out of, and that was also really hard. Now, maybe that's the same as saying, oh, it was all worth it. But I don't want to reduce it to that. I don't want to reduce it to that simple formula that somehow solves everything or that somehow takes away all the hardship. You know, it's all real. It's all there. And so it's about accepting the whole experience. And so that's what I tried to get that through to my kids. I didn't just emphasize the horrible things. I didn't just emphasize, you know, the wonderful things. And I think, as far as I could tell, they were all pretty healthy. My daughter, maybe most especially, because she was 21 when she left and she had a degree in religion already. She was in great shape and she probably did have the most, you know, contented sort of mission. But I think my sons were also pretty realistic. I think they might have beat themselves up a little bit too, but I hope not as much as I did.
That's for sure. And I love, you know, throughout the book, you have these, and you're a great writer, and I applaud you in that effort. And so it's fun to read. And it's not necessarily, it's a comedic book, but there's some humorous parts, more of just you describing the culture of being a missionary and how you refer to missionaries as these businessmen, because it's, you know, depending on what culture you go to, it is sort of silly that we are walking around looking like CIA agents.
Well, that's what we were told. We were supposed to dress like the local businessmen. And so, and we used to go to the mission home in Salt Lake, it was called, for 5 days before you went to the MTC, which was then called the LTM Language Training Mission. And that was one of the first things I remember being struck by, is like, local businessmen. It's like, you know, and Jesus was a local businessman somehow. That was kind of the idea. So that's why that was an acceptable model. But anyway, mostly it kind of, you don't really look like the local businessman. We didn't look like any local businessman, even though we were dressed like an American businessman in the 1950s. That's what we were dressed like. We didn't look like the local businessman in the 1970s, for sure.
And now I think it's become more of a uniform than trying to look like a local businessman. And it works.
Yeah. It's changed lately. So, you know, it's not quite as strict as before. And I think that's because I think if it makes people think you're weird, you know, I mean, if the idea is to just kind of stand out a little, that's one thing. But if it makes people think you're just downright weird and you're a cult, then it's not good.
Right. Yeah. That's, I think, important is people are learning from the missionaries to involve the members so they don't think, oh, if I join this church, I have to dress in a suit and tie or a white shirt and tie every day. And that's just what they do. Obviously, that's for the missionaries. But you talk about this. Let's talk about this experience you had in one of your apartments, in the attic of your apartment. Was it the attic or kind of the upstairs of your apartment that really kind of shifted things and was a spiritual experience for you?
Yeah, this was...
How did that unfold? And
that's when I began to... Again, there was nobody telling me to do this, right? And that's why it was kind of scary. Because if you learn this lesson, you're probably not necessarily learning it from the rhetoric you hear, but you're learning it from experience. And so it's kind of out of desperation that I shifted my ideal. My ideal wasn't working. I wasn't becoming this person with 84 converts and people running to thank me for helping them, you know, join the church. And one day in my apartment, I just felt so low. And I remember wanting to pray and I couldn't even really pray. I was just kind of blank. And I just remember this feeling coming over me to just be myself and quit trying to be something else. And that was the most disappointing feeling ever, because the last person I wanted to be was myself. That was the whole point of going on a mission, was to be heroic. That was why I had this big goal of 84, you know? So I didn't want to do that. And yet the longer I sat there and felt and thought about it and felt about it, the more I thought, you know, that really is the right thing. It wasn't nearly as heroic as saying, I'm going to jump up. You know, you don't get the goosebump kind of thing that you get when you feel heroic. It was much calmer than that. And the longer I've lived, the more I've learned to trust that the right answer is probably not the heroic one. It's probably the calm one. It's probably the one where you're, you know, within yourself and you're feeling kind toward other people instead of like you're going to show everybody how to do things. And that was a surprising answer. And I didn't learn it overnight, but I never forgot that. And in future months on my mission, when I felt kind of really down again, I always remembered that. And I went back to it. And every time it worked. And, you know, it's like what William James called pragmatism, but he got it right out of Jesus. You know, by your fruits, you shall know them. If it works, you do it. And it worked. You know, every time I did it, I felt so much more content. I felt happier being around people, being around my companions. And so it was a surprising answer, again, not the answer I expected. And I kept doing it. But again, I wasn't told that. You know, the rhetoric was never just be yourself. The rhetoric was always be better. You can do better. If you had to sum up the talks, it would probably kind of be something like, you're doing it wrong. You know, here's how you can do it better. Yeah.
And I love that message. And I wrote, as I read that chapter, I just felt that, you know, it was to me a chapter on the grace of Jesus Christ. And I had a similar experience, not only on my mission, but serving in church leadership, where you get called and you're like, okay, it's up to me. You know, I've been set apart. I'm the leader now. I'm going to make some changes and really dig up some success. And then somewhere along the way, the Spirit, the Savior just quickly tells you, you are not called to fix it. You are not called to save everything. I'm the Savior. You are not, you know, so just be yourself and let me make up the difference and do the saving rather than you think taking on your shoulders. And to me, it was such a strong message of grace. Would you categorize it like that?
Oh, yeah, that's what it felt like. Absolutely. I mean, you feel grace when you're hopeless and helpless and when you probably don't really deserve something. And that's what Mormons, including me, are bad at, is we think you earn grace, you know, and grace by definition is something you don't deserve. So that's definitely how you feel. And what that does is it makes you more grateful and makes you more inclined to be kind to those around you and so on, because you've had this kindness extended to you. That's what grace is. So I think sometimes we're afraid to talk about grace and those kinds of things because we think it will make people lazy. I think it does just the opposite. It just makes you kinder and calmer.
Now, one of my, I don't know if it'd be my most favorite chapter, but the one I definitely smiled the most during was this experience you had of when you almost became, or you thought you were becoming the assistant to the president, the AP of your mission. And it took me back to a time in my mission. I served in Sacramento, California. I was a Spanish elder, and I was, you know, probably 18 months out or so. And, you know, I'm a district leader, and you know, it's funny, you talk about throughout the book, this culture of, or these idealisms that missionaries create, even this ongoing discussion of which is the correct sacrament prayer to read that you talk about. But nonetheless, you know, we sort of get this impression that in order to be a successful missionary, not only do you have to baptize, but you also have to write home at some point and tell your mother, I have become a zone leader or a district leader or assistant to the president, right? And I remember this time when the zone leader was going home. And I was the district leader in the area. I was next up, you know, and I felt this inner struggle of like, oh, I shouldn't pray to be this calling. You're not supposed to do that. And I remember the mission president transferred in another guy to be his own leader. And I finished my mission as a district leader. Right. But I learned so many leadership principles from that. So just tell us briefly that experience of when you thought you were going to become AP and what you learned about leadership from that.
Right. Right. Well, I was in this lowly position. In the mission office is basically the printer and librarian, I guess, to translate it. And but I was really good. My office was next to the assistants. And so, I had to walk through their office to get to mine. And I got to be really good friends with them. Anyway, we liked each other a lot. When it came to the transfer day, they were moving their people around on their board. And they put my picture up in the assistant area because one of the assistants was going home, and I happened to see this and I was just overwhelmed. And so the whole day I had this huge heroic feeling, you know, I didn't learn my lesson overnight, right? This is one of the many ways I had to keep learning it, but I had the big heroic feeling coming over me again. You know, here it was, if maybe I wasn't baptizing people, but at least I was going to be the assistant to the president. And this was sure to mark me as a successful missionary. And finally the mission and the assistants were gone all that day. They were out visiting, you know, some other missionaries. And so that whole day I was just, you know, thinking to myself, I'm the only one who knew this secret. And anyway, they get home the next day and I see them and my good friend who's the assistant, he says, hey, did you see our joke? What did you think about it? And I was just crushed. Just absolutely crushed. Yeah, yeah. Because here I was sure this was going to happen to me. And, you know, it's one of many things that taught me that we just look for affirmation and feelings of success in all the wrong places. Again, just like Jesus said, we all look on the outward thing and we almost can't help it. We look at how people dress and how they appear and what position they have and how many conversions they have. And we can't even see into their heart. You know, but still we think these are the things that matter. And so that's one of many lessons I learned to try to get away from that mode and try to figure out what is real success? What should my real ideals be?
So since your mission, have you had any other experience? Because I think this, you know, the lessons that we're all learning, which is this lesson you articulate in your book, have you felt like there, you've been in other positions where some of those, false idealistic, you know, measuring sticks are there, but are you better reminding yourself that it's not about you, or have you caught yourself sort of falling into this pattern again? Because I know I have, but what's your experience been like?
Yeah, again, you don't learn it overnight. I mean, I have to say the lessons were so hard and heavy during my mission that I learned them pretty good by the time I went home. But there were still things, you know, how you're sitting there in the congregation and somebody's called to be a bishop. And your first thought is, you know, inside it could be, gee, why wasn't that me? Why wasn't I good enough or whatever? And then you realize you got it all wrong again, you know? And I think I got to the point even 10 or 15 years ago where I probably didn't think that anymore. I was just do what you can wherever you are. Mostly you try to be kind to people around you, and it doesn't really matter what position you have. But again, we reinforce this with the rhetoric. You know, like when somebody is called to be a bishop, all the parents come in, all the kids come in, all the grandkids come in. Somebody's called to be a nursery leader. You don't see that happening, you know. So again, we're saying we're saying this is way more important. We're all going to make this trip, but somehow all positions are equally important, right? So we kind of keep doing it ourselves. We kind of keep promoting this culture when really we probably should all just trade off positions all the time. And just, you know, you do it for a while, I'll do it for a while, and you know, we all make our contribution how we can.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And really it's an inspired model of the church, you know, the lay leadership model where, you know, we trade off every five or so years as far as the bishop or those things. And I think leaders that, you know, currently being in a state presidency, we've made a real effort of, you know, when we do a bishopric change, let's not reserve the whole meeting for testimonies of the outgoing and the incoming, because we're sort of setting this false precedent of these callings are more important and we need to hear from them. Right. So we try and just make the calling and move on and, you know, respect the authority, obviously the keys that are in place, but don't tie those directly to the person. And it's difficult. It's hard to do. And I still fall into those traps of thinking, we need to handle this a little more carefully since it's this or that position, but it's a tough lesson, but definitely a leadership lesson.
Yeah.
So before I want to talk a little bit about the end of your mission and how things shifted there. But now you teach at BYU with you're a history professor. You're in the history department. Is that?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And mainly focused on European history.
Right. Religious history.
Oh, religious.
Nice.
So do you feel like that interest came from your mission, or did you always sort of have a historical?
Oh, definitely.
Preference?
I mean, that's one of the things they say, that I clearly got a lot of things out of it. I mean, if I grew up in Fresno, California, I had no idea about things in Europe, wasn't really interested in other religions. And so, you know, being sent to Belgium changed my whole life because it got me interested in languages, in history, in religion. And yeah, that definitely led me it had a lot to do with my becoming a professor of European religious history.
Nice. And so obviously you're there now for a number of weeks, but do you go back quite a bit? And
every summer I come somewhere to Europe to do research for books on the history of Christianity. Yeah, so I've written books about Catholic subjects and Protestant subjects. My newest book is about Martin Luther, because 2017 is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Yeah, so I study all forms of Christianity, basically.
That's awesome. And your wife served her mission in France, so you've got, it's the Flemish-French dynamic. You can pretty much go anywhere in Belgium.
That's right, yeah.
And how would you say, just curious, how's the church in Belgium doing? Obviously, the Paris, France temple just was dedicated, and I assume they're in that temple district. How would you describe the church there?
Part of the nation is in Paris, because half of Belgium speaks French, the other half speaks Dutch. The Dutch speakers go to The Hague in the Netherlands, and the French speakers go to Paris. There was actually a recent move made that caused a lot of discussion. There's a really nice post about it on the blog Times and Seasons by Wilfried de Kooy, who's Belgian, and he discusses what happened. There were basically 12 units in Flemish Belgium, and 8 of them were disbanded, and these were merged into 4, and this caused a lot of discussion and difficulty. You know, it's always hard here, and I discuss this in my book. One of the things I didn't understand as a missionary was why people convert. And we reduce that to a kind of single narrative as well, that they just feel the Spirit and they're honest in heart and they convert. I'm not saying that doesn't play any role, but I think it's inscrutable in the end. It's like love. Why do you love somebody? Can you really explain it? However, things that you can measure as to why people convert, because I've since studied conversion and written a book about it, and sure, that had to do with being a missionary as well, is that the number one thing that you can measure as to why people convert is their relationships. Their social relationships and their social structures. And so the reason people convert or don't convert or stay in a church or leave a church is because of those relationships. If you leave, it's because you see more promising relationships elsewhere. If you stay, it's probably because you have lots of ties and so on. I mean, and this isn't saying that you don't have any faith or any, you know, conviction. It's just saying that this plays a big role and it's tied in with everything else. So what I didn't understand as a missionary was how strong those were. And that if people left their family and their society to join the church, they weren't just leaving you know, making an individual decision. They were cutting themselves off from their culture. If you become Mormon in the U.S., you know, you might have some problems, but there are so many converting Americans. 44% of American adults change religion at least once. And there's so much conversion going on, and they're so used to dealing with it. There are some parts of the country like Utah or the South where maybe it causes more trouble than other if you convert. But, you know, you're pretty much used to dealing with it. You're not used to the rupture that you cause in cultures like Belgium. And if I had known that, it would have been so much easier. But the idea was, no, we can't tell them things like that because they won't try as hard. And really, we just would have tried differently. I don't think we would have tried any less hard. We would have gone into it with more understanding of what we were doing. And so I guess that answers one of your earlier questions. What are some ways you can prepare people? Instead of insisting that every mission is the same and it depends only on your faith, discuss these kinds of social structures that make it hard. These are the structures that keep so many people in Utah Mormon, right? And why there are so many baptisms there, because so many people around them are Mormon. It's perfectly acceptable. And if you understand that, you feel less of an individual failure. And it's not so much about you. We make the missions too much about the missionary. And what you learn, the thing I learned that I didn't expect to learn, was that it really is more about other people and you just learning to be interested in them, be kind to them, share what you have with them, but also learn from them. That's what I didn't expect. I never expected to learn from, we're there to teach other people, right? But really, I learned so much from them.
Yeah. And I think that's a perfect transition to what I want to ask you as far as the end of your mission, where you made the shift from focusing on who am I converting to who am I befriending, who am I creating a relationship with that's beneficial, right? And I think many times in the culture of missionaries, we give, you know, obviously we do want to focus on conversion, on baptisms, on growing the church. I mean, that's their purpose. But I think back to the 70s, if, you know, with hindsight, you know, the best thing missionaries could do in the 70s and 80s in Belgium was create strong relationships with people so they had a positive outlook on the LDS church. So for maybe now or in the last 10 years, we're closer to the step of, okay, now that you know we're good people, that there's more deeper relationships, let's talk more about what we believe. And then that natural step could take place. Would you agree with that? Is that?
Yeah, there's something to that. I think ironic. I remember even hearing, we were specifically told, you're not going there to make friends. And he used to say that in a little white book. Yeah. You're not going to make friends. Ironic. We often, again, have it backwards. I think we have really good intentions. And, you know, you're young and of course you're going to learn stuff. You're not going to know all this stuff before you go. Part of the reason to go is you learn. But I think we can do a better job talking about some of these things. People always say to me, oh, every missionary should read your book before they go. And I go, actually, it's more of a book to read after your mission. It's a mission recovery book, you know, to help you make sense of it. But I have to say, there have been a few, like my nephew read it before he left on his mission, and he really loved it. And he went to Albania, which is, you know, no easy place to go. And I think I get the sense reading his letters that he remembers some of the things he read. And it's not like I have all the answers, but just, I mean, in the sense of just enjoying the people and getting to know them and so on, and not being so goal-oriented. I mean, there's something perverse about saying, I'm going to get 12 baptisms and having these goals. There's something really perverse about that. It almost denies the value of that person for their own sake. It makes it about you again, instead of about, you know, people you're trying to help and love. And I think about the one of the Mormon ideals is Ammon. And what was Ammon trying to do? It's like, I'm going to go there and just be a shepherd for 14 years if I have to, you know? I mean, why not? Why not do something like that? I mean, to me, there's this pride in kind of, we're doing 4 service hours a week now on missions, you know? It's like, in some places, it should be like 40. And forget the proselytizing. The proselytizing will follow when people realize, you know, these are really interesting people. But if you did 40 service hours a week and felt like you were doing something really valuable, you'd feel better than if you went and were just feeling like people hated you all the time. You know, I mean, I would have felt like I was doing something at least.
Yeah, for sure. And making a difference in the community. And I love how you classify that this isn't, you know, not that there's any harm in recommending this book to somebody preparing for a mission, but I definitely gained from it, reflecting on my own experiences. I read that, and I think the other lesson there is I remember being a young missionary, just suddenly being made aware of these realities of the difficulties of being a mission. And my sister would write me a letter, you know, talking about the difficulties of her mission. And that really helped, you know, it showed a lot of empathy. towards my experience. And so, you know, those, you know, bishops or parents or leaders out there writing to missionaries, you know, it's okay to say, you know, this part was really difficult for me and this is how I handled it. And, but it's, you know, I remember showing up feeling like I'm the only one that doesn't have a problem, or I'm the only one that has a problem with being a missionary. Like everybody else just seems normal and this is their life, but it just must be me. And so these experiences really help.
No, exactly. And that, and again, in the rhetoric, it's not that people don't admit the difficulties. It's more that they treat the difficulties as kind of just a prelude to this great, glorious event, you know, that's bound to happen. And it actually happened to my daughter. You know, she baptized someone the day before she went home. And it almost happened to me. I write about that. And then it didn't. And it was just crushing. It was just crushing again. Even though I learned my lesson, I still hadn't learned it all the way. I think it just helps to realize, again, it doesn't, it's not necessarily, you know, gonna go the way you thought. And then it's okay to talk about that instead of having to conclude, oh, sometimes it will be hard, but don't worry, it'll all, you know, it's all going to be, you know, it's going to fit this ideal that everybody always talks about. And no, let it fit your own ideal. Let it create your own experience. You know, get out of it what you yourself get instead of what you think people expect you to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, you talk about learning your lesson through your mission and through your life. And even reading your book, I was almost expecting that last paragraph to be this story about you dropped a pamphlet in a coffee house and you later found out that that turned into 84 baptisms, right? And that, oh, it did work. You know, I did. That wasn't just, but it didn't come. But that, like you said, you weren't trying to put a pretty bow at the end like that. It's just, it is what it is. And it's a beautiful story for sure.
Yeah. I think leaders would do missionaries a lot of good by just leaving it there instead of making it, because then when the big moment doesn't come, they still feel lousy. I mean, sometimes it's enough just to be with someone and just to suffer with them. You know, Jesus could have said that when Lazarus was dead. He could have said, oh, don't worry, he's going to resurrect. But instead, you know, he's weeping and he brings him back to life because he's so sad about this. You just listen sometimes. You just suffer with them. And that's really what they need.
Now, you talk about these different characters, and obviously these are real people, you know, companions. And I don't know if you changed their name or whatever. But
yeah, I changed all the names.
Okay, good. So you talk about Elder Downing, and you know, he was your district leader in the MTC or the LTM, and you respected him and you just thought he was an incredible missionary. And then later on, you became his companion. You were excited for that experience. And then you just did not jive well. And you sort of had a mutual, I don't want to say disdain, or but there's this mutual respect of like, you stand over there, I'll stand over here, and we'll finish our mission separate. I'm guessing he's either ended up as an Area 70 or in federal prison. I'm not sure which.
I don't know. But he's ended up. Oh, you know, one of the points I try to make is, at first, when you have a problem like that, you think it's all the other person's fault. And in the end, when you look back on it and you get older, you realize, you know, yeah, you just didn't get along. And it's probably both people's fault to some extent. And so, yeah, it was hard. You go through life and there are people, some people you clash with more than others just by being in the same room. You know, it's not just a question of you getting to know each other. It's like automatic from the start, and other people you click with right away. And so, and part of it is learning how to get along with all kinds of people. And I did value that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it described the dynamic of companionships well, that, you know, regardless of who it is, it's difficult to be around somebody 24 hours a day. And even if you're missionaries and happy, that's the way it is. So.
Yeah.
Well, Craig, I appreciate the good book you wrote. And again, it's Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled, but not even close to tragic confessions of a real life Mormon missionary. And does that title, I came across in Hebrews 2, does that come from a verse of scripture, the way below the angels?
Exactly. But originally from the Psalms, right? First, it was in the Psalms and Paul was, Hebrews was quoting it. And it says a little lower than the angels, but.
But you felt more. I love that. And a great book cover and a very engaging book. Well, Craig, just in closing, you know, well, before I ask you a final question, if people want to learn more about this book or other books you've written, where would you send them and learn more about your research?
Nowadays, probably on Amazon.com. You can also go on my website, craigharleen.com, and you can see the other sorts of books I've written. I try to write for a general audience all the time, and certainly being a historian informed how I wrote about my mission. You know, so I'm kind of writing about it from the standpoint of a 20-year-old and also partly from the standpoint of a professor of European religious history. You know, I mean, I've learned a lot about religion since then. So I bring some of that into the book as well. So it's certainly, being a historian had a lot to do with how I wrote that book.
Nice. And, you know, in closing, this is a question I typically ask people I interview, and you've sort of already answered it a few times, but just in final to articulate, how has your mission and really this understanding how the gospel works, how your relationship works with your Savior, how has that made you a better disciple or follower of Jesus Christ?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's made me better. I'm not sure. I guess as you get older, you just feel like, well, this is kind of who I am. And it doesn't seem to measure up to, again, the ideals you had in mind. I hope it's, the more you feel grace, I do think the more you're just thoughtful about people and kind about people. And I still don't think I do that completely, including with my own kids. But I think I've gotten better at it. I think some people are naturally better at it than others. But I think it's being a little more patient, a little more tolerant of people's foibles, just of who they are. I think you just feel that more as you get older. And I think being a missionary had a lot to do with that.
Such a fun interview. I appreciate Craig Harleen being willing to sit down with me through the magic of Skype as he's enjoying the beautiful weather in Belgium and talking about his book. I hope, you may not agree with everything we discussed here or have a different perspective on things, and that's fine. I encourage you nonetheless to go check out his book and read it. I think it's a quick read, it's a fun read, and very well written, and I think it will bring you wonderful memories, maybe not so wonderful memories at times, of your time as a mission, but really just the realities of being a missionary. And I hope that we can all take the steps to prepare missionaries as we meet with them, whether in interviews or if they're loved ones that are leaving, that we can have conversations with them that aren't all based on hyperbole, right? That aren't just these grandiose experiences, though they happen. I know they happen in my mission, but a lot of the day-to-day, a lot of these experiences is more about self-development and what you're learning about the gospel. You're learning about your relationship with your Savior. And I hope we, as we prepare these missionaries, I think they'll be more likely to enjoy their mission as they are aware of some of these less than ideal experiences that many of us have had as a missionary. Nevertheless, I invite you to consider being a core leader in the leading LDS community and joining the online newsletter, social media, and being a monthly donor. We definitely need your help. No matter how small the price, be a monthly donor and contribute to the good cause that we're doing, our mission to enhance the leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in the context of the church. So go to leadinglds.org and click on the donate button and find more information about being a monthly donor core leader. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.